Thank you all, please have a seat. Good afternoon, we're here today to hear the case of in the matter of John R. Olson. May I have the entry of appearances, please, first?
Good afternoon, Your Honor, I am John R. Olson.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court, Charles Morton.
Thank you, Mr. Morton. We have set this case for 1 hour, that is to say that each side has a half an hour. Counsel, you'll need to keep track of your own time. Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, this is an appeal from a disciplinary decision against me in which the disciplinary panel voted 2-1 that I was culpable and the third judge said no. The tribunal, and I would suggest it was just 2 of 3 judges, then made a further determination in chambers by taking judicial notice of something without coming out to tell us that they were doing that or giving us any opportunity to discuss that issue, which had never been raised in the underlying hearing. What happened was Judge Lucero and or his other judge, 4 months after this hearing concluded, wrote an opinion that I had misled the tribunal and therefore should be suspended from the practice of law for 6 months. In other words, they enhanced under that and 3 other factors that I will discuss initially. The findings in that respect were disturbing to me for many reasons, of course, but also because if Judge Lucero looked at the internet, which he asserted he did, taking judicial notice of it, he could not have helped but notice multiple entries on the internet right next to what he was looking at that reported 2 Social Security addresses in the city of Boulder. And I submitted those to the tribunal, and they're part of the record before this Supreme Court. I cannot fathom how he came to the conclusion that I must have known, I suppose is what he's saying, he didn't say it outright, that there was only 1 office in Boulder. I represented that I went to the office that I saw, which was the closest one to my office in northeast Boulder. The internet shows another office at 655 South Broadway in South Boulder, and even the city of Longmont, even today, this morning, is telling its citizens that's the office to go to. Now, if Judge Lucero had thought that he might want to mention this to us, he could have reconvened the hearing and said, Mr. Olson, what do you have to say about that? And we would have been happy to discuss it, as I'm sure Mr. Moorman as well. What's interesting about that issue is that it tainted my credibility in a fierce way throughout this hearing. And in our legal brief, we pointed out 3 other times when whoever wrote the decision of the 2 judges made findings of fact that were erroneous, plainly erroneous from the record. Recalling, of course, that the tribunal did not have the transcripts. We had that prepared for this appeal. One of them was that we had, in essence, tried to deceive the tribunal by asserting that in the underlying litigation, Ms. Walker, the opposing attorney, had withheld documents from us. And as we have proven in our briefing, with citations to the record, she admitted several times in her own testimony with Mr. Mortimer and me present that she did withhold documents from us, despite my persistent requests, including a request in writing to come to her office and look at what she was disclosing because I could tell she was not giving us all of her documents. And you will see we quote her multiple times in the transcript saying yes. And she produced these spurious reasons for not providing her documents. And I would suggest that she was required to automatically disclose those documents under the automatic disclosure rules that we have to scrupulously follow in federal court. On April 20th, 2010, Ms. Walker sent me a letter. This was not the first time that she suggested that something was amiss. For example, she had asserted previously that my client lied in stating that she used to work for the United States Air Force. And she adduced an affidavit from an Air Force Academy officer saying that. We then adduced records from the United States Air Force proving that she did work for the United States Air Force, including her competency exams, her job title, her classifications, and everything. And that Air Force Academy officer had to come back and issue a new affidavit to the federal court in Denver saying, whoops, they're right, she did work for the Air Force. So this is not the first red herring. It was one of several that we had to deal with. The corporation that we brought this case against defended at an unemployment hearing at Gregory, and it had previously tried to take from our client, in a case that I had nothing to do with, her patented or copyrighted computer codes in a battle that I had nothing to do with that had already occurred. The defense attorney in this case tried to bring that into this case by asking a question about those patented codes or those copyrighted codes. Furthermore, they took a deposition from my client's mother-in-law on the record asking her if she was aware that years ago our client was pregnant when she married his son, first son. This was the way this case was litigated from the outset. So we received this letter on April 20th, 2010. It's Exhibit AC. I asked if you have the opportunity to look at the exhibit and also look at the scheduling order that was entered in the federal case that we're talking about. That scheduling order is a typical kind of order required in every federal case, in which we are required to report to the judge and agree or not agree that all discovery will be formal or whether we can do informal discovery. We both agreed that it would only be formal discovery and it's entered into that order signed by the magistrate judge once another. From that point forward in that case, we were not permitted to proceed by informal discovery. We were required to proceed by formal discovery, and that's why I tendered to Ms. Walker Exhibit AZ, pages 7 and 14, because she had told me my client was lying. She told me that orally a couple days before she sent the letter of April 20th. So I sent her a discovery request that said, please set forth the sum and substance of any and all discussions and or communications in which you contend or anyone contends that plaintiff, quote, lied, end quote, was untruthful or misrepresented anything at any time. And we have set forth her response to that discovery request, which in your long experience, you recognize is called stonewalling. She did not provide that. I followed up with an email letter saying, please tell us what lies you are referring to. That's Exhibit AD. She didn't respond to that. In the meantime, recognizing that we were pressing for depositions from people because we wanted to find out the truth of what happened in this case, she filed a motion to quash them. That motion was filed 7 days after that letter was sent to our office, and probably 5 or 6 days after it was received and read by me in my office. And the judge, well, now we did indeed quash our deposition, and that's Exhibit A, B, as in Victor. We continued to press to try to use the formal discovery means available to us to learn the truth about what she said in her letter. And she filed a motion to close all discovery. And Judge Watanabe granted it twice, completely freezing our ability to use the formal discovery devices that we thought entitled to use to learn the truth behind these alleged accusations. But before she filed that motion, there was a little gap of time of maybe 45 days or so in which I pressed Ms. Walker repeatedly to look at her documents, to proceed with depositions, and to tell us what lies she was referring to. And what we got back from her was this: stonewalling, nothing except, "We are standing down, Mr. Olson." She wrote that twice. "We are standing down." She's saying you're refusing to participate. That's Exhibit BC and Exhibit M. You know, I was born at night, but not last night. And I happen to not recall that procedure being identified in any rule of civil procedure, state or federal. She did not have the right to do that, but she was doing it. And so there was a gap of time even before Judge Montanabe entered his order freezing discovery, which she refused to participate in discovery. What did that mean as a practical thing? Well, the most serious thing it meant is we couldn't take depositions from the two companies you may know or may eventually read about, Blackstone and Quest, in which we had the right to ask, was she an employee or was she an independent contractor? Did you pay her wages or fees? When did she work for you and when did she not work for you? Please produce all of your records. We were forbidden to do that. We couldn't do those depositions. However, the deposition of our client had begun. The reason is we cooperated in the scheduling of depositions and they got to do all that. Not only that, we gave them releases for Blackstone, Quest, her entire medical file going back for her whole life, educational records. We gave them, we offered to submit all of our email communications, confidential attorney-client communications back and forth to a neutral magistrate judge or mediator, moderator, so he or she could examine them to see if we had said anything inculpatory in them. Ms. Walker said, no, she didn't want to do that. She wanted to see it herself. We gave them all of our documents, which disclosed Blackstone, Quest. We provided everything possible that she asked for, and including the beginning of our client's deposition. And it was in that deposition that Ms. Millott, our client, made some statements that were, in my view, unclear about whether she considered herself to be an employee of either of those two entities, Blackstone and Quest, or an independent contractor. Well, as it turns out, she was an independent contractor receiving fees at various times. So I spoke with my client, and she said, oh, I didn't mean to give that impression. I'd like to correct this. Well, you have that opportunity because this deposition is not over with. I have a chance to ask you questions. As a decent attorney, I pressed to have that scheduling accomplished. Ms. Walker refused to participate in it. She refused to let us finish the deposition, and it never happened. If it had happened, our client would have been also given a correction sheet pursuant to the normal rules of civil procedure. She had a right to correct her deposition transcript with an actual correction page or pages that she would have received, but of course, that never happened in this case. We have discussed in our legal brief all of the other, what we would call, evasions that we face, but I ask you to focus on the number of days that we had between the letter of April 20, 2010, Exhibit AC, and the time that Ms. Millott's efforts to find out the truth through me were halted, simply halted by Ms. Walker declaring that they were standing down and would not participate anymore in this case. It is a matter of days, and I can't remember for sure the count. I'm trying to figure it out right now, but it might have been 40 days or 45 days or so. I think it's less, possibly less than that. When the case was shut down, and during that time frame, all formal discovery efforts were halted by Ms. Walker, and then by order of the court. Now, in the meantime, what was I supposed to do as her attorney? First of all, we determined to find out from Blackstone and Quest what the heck was going on here. So I walked down to Blackstone's office in the Quest building and went up and met with the people there. First, I met with the receptionist. I said, have you ever employed Ms. Galata? They went back, well, maybe. I said, no, she's not on any of our records. But that's interesting, but it fits with what I'm hearing from my client, that she wasn't an employee, which is what the opposing side was intended. She was an independent contractor. I did not stop there. I contacted Blackstone's office in San Francisco and asked them, please tell us what you know about Melissa Galata. And then an interesting thing unfolded. They refused to help me in any way, whatever, during my second and third calls to them. And what we now know, in the meantime, Ms. Walker had contacted them last year in California and said, beware, she has a federal lawsuit against a communications company in Colorado, beware. And I believe that's why they claimed that they wouldn't talk with us. Well, when that happens, we know, we just have to subpoena them. They conduct a deposition of it. Except all discovery was frozen, and we were forbidden to do that. Judge Wampanoag himself crossed our depositions at Exhibit A, B, as in Victor, on April 27th, 2010. That was a mere 7 days after the letter arrived. So, with those points, I hope you understand why I speak, I suppose, that my wife says so much driving me about this. It has been devastating personally and professionally to me and my practice and my family. But there is objectively a more important principle involved here today in this argument. And that is that this tribunal waited 4 months to issue an opinion, no transcript, and then accused me of things that were simply false, as shown and proven definitively in the transcript. But worse than that,
I'm a little confused by the facts. Did you go to both of these Boulder Social Security Administration offices?
No, I went to the first one. The only one that was there is to try to find out what was going on.
Okay, and so what's the significance of the other one?
Well, when you have an opportunity to read the decision of the disciplinary tribunal, you will see that my punishment was enhanced because of the tribunal, two of the judges concluded I tried to deceive the tribunal by suggesting in a question of a witness, not stating, but suggesting in a question, that there were two Social Security offices in Boulder.
And you'll see. And you verified that there were two. Is that right?
No. I looked at the internet to find out where the office was, saw it, and went.
Okay, and part of this whole factual issue has to do with your client's misuse of the Social Security number.
Your Honor, alleged misuse, which we've proven now, is not true at all.
Right.
And proven through this procedure, and I'll discuss that soon also. But if you could, Your Honor, please also have a caveat to look at Judge Lucero's later ruling, post-decision ruling,
right,
in which the same issue came up, the issue of whether I had deceived anybody with my question. Mr. Mortimer filed a motion to not let me suspend my punishment until we had a chance to appeal. And then if he asserted that I had deceived the tribunal, Judge Lucero looked at that in detail months later and reversed himself and said I hadn't. Same issue, identical.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't actually reverse himself. I don't think he knew he was doing that. I think he forgot what he ruled before. I don't think he intentionally reversed my practice. So he just reversed it and said I was not trying to deceive anybody. And of course I was not trying to deceive anybody. And that was a legitimate question to ask of anybody who ever looked at the internet and said, oh, there's two addresses in Boulder. Which one do I go to? And which one did that address go to? Because, by the way, there was an issue of the stamp, or the, I'm sorry, the ticket you get when you go in. Mr. Mortimer contended that their ticket that their investigator got was different than our ticket. And that raised an issue in my office. She went to the other office. And that's why I asked that question. Judge Lucero did reverse himself on that, but I'm still suffering a penalty.
Stay with that just a minute, Mr. Olson. That confused me. I'm not sure I processed that point. So are you saying now that it was expressed in the opinion that your punishment was based in part on something found by Judge Lucero and the other members of the board, and Judge Lucero at a later point expressly indicated that he was wrong in finding that fact?
No, close, but not quite. His opinion makes clear that he and the other judge who found against me, I don't think the third judge participated in this, I doubt it, or he would have not let it happen, I'm pretty sure. But in that back room, their chambers, Judge Lucero, and he's written this opinion, you'll see that in his decision, right, did his own internet research.
But what happened afterwards with regard to that and his feeling about the facts upon which they, yes, they based the aggravation?
Your Honor, he then wrote that because I had intentionally deceived the board, and he cited a law that says I can't do that, that my punishment should be enhanced to 6 month suspension.
And what happened after that?
And then after that, the decision was reached, and we filed our appeal. And we felt it was appropriate to stay this punishment to keep my practice and house from going under. And we filed a motion to stay. And Judge Moore, Mr. Moore, then proceeded to argue that we had deceived the tribunal. And in that exact same situation, the same fact pattern. And Judge Lucero issued an opinion which you have before you, reversing himself, but he didn't say I heard I reverse myself. He just issued the opposite opinion, that I had not tried to deceive anybody, and that he found the basis for such a finding. And you'll see that in the subsequent opinion that we've submitted and we supplement the record. The final philosophical or legalistic point that I was hoping to make here, although I'm running out of time, is that this decision, which will, if you affirm it, have my name associated with it in perpetuity, will turn ethic law here on its head, because as the ethics decisions that Judge Lyons noted point out, that a lawyer in Colorado has always been bound to resolve doubts about the veracity of testimony or other evidence in favor of his client. That's the ethical rule that applies to me. This decision says something different. This decision says if an opposing lawyer sends you a letter making accusations against your client, then freezes the entire case by fiat or by court order, I must immediately accept those accusations as true and dismiss my client's claim or fire my client. That was the argument made by Ms. Walker, and that is the reason why this tribunal ruled against me. In essence, saying we should have dropped the client or dropped her claim for back pay. There is a legal principle involved that this court, the Supreme Court, may have seen, that says that she can't win damages for any period of time when she got a job somewhere else. So if she was earning $10,000 a year at one job, she got another job paying $11,000. She had no damages for that period of working. But a principle of law that applied in this case that this tribunal never even looked at is the Godinet case in the Tenth Circuit, in which the law was unequivocally established that even if she got another job, she was entitled to her lost pay for the weeks and months she was unemployed. My argument was based on the law, and I had a right to make that for my client. I don't care if it's a big corporation. She had a right to win it.
Well, let me ask you this, are you contesting any basis for sanction here?
I'm absolutely contesting them all.
Finding of a failure to reasonably investigate and negligently pursuing these claims. You don't believe that's based on any facts in the record that support that?
It is not based on any facts in the record.
Okay. And what's our standard of review on that issue?
De novo. you're the backstop against this kind of tribunal. You have a judge there.
Well, I'm talking about the factual findings. You think the factual findings are not supported by any evidence? That's your contention?
Absolutely, and they are erroneous factual findings. We did everything we could. We hired an investigator in Florida to go to the home of the alleged other Sandra Prince. And we've shown you that we were thwarted in our ability to take her deposition. And further, we were thwarted in our ability to even speak with her, because Ms. Walker, after my last attempt to speak with Ms. Prince in Florida, and this is the living Ms. Prince, not the previous one they sent in Kingman, we sent an investigator to her door two or three times and also left a note, never responded. I then said, well, this is getting urgent now, and I left a message for him saying, this is urgent, please contact us. All we want to do is see a photo of your associated card, a copy of it, or any document that had you in the room. Members of the Supreme Court, the very next day, I got a call, a message left in my office from Ms. Walker saying, you may not speak with her. I am her attorney now. And I was forbidden to contact her. Furthermore, Ms. Walker refused to give us her address, you already knew it, and her phone number to confirm we had the right person, despite the automatic disclosure rules. She armed herself out to be an attorney of a pivotal witness in a matter in which that law firm billed $400,000 to their attorney to stop me from even talking with her. And we begged, in writing, just send us a copy of her card. Just send us a document with their number on it. And we were stonewalled at every single request through right now. So with only 4 minutes left, if you don't mind, can I say something?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Please. Mr. Mortimer?
May it please the court. Again, my name is Charles Mortimer. I represent the appellee people in the state of Colorado. This is, as Ms. Wilson says, an appeal from a disciplinary hearing in which the majority of the hearing board, made detailed factual findings, documented those findings in the record, made a comprehensive legal analysis, and determined that Mr. Wilson had violated Rules 3.1 and 8.4D of the Rules of Professional Conduct. Rule 3.1 prohibits a lawyer from asserting an issue in a proceeding, and I paraphrase, an issue in a proceeding unless there is a basis in fact for doing so that is not frivolous. And the hearing board quite carefully reviewed the law and determined that the standard in making a determination such as this is whether there is an objectively reasonable basis for asserting the issue. And determined in this case, Mr. Olson had asserted several issues for which there was no objectively reasonable basis. Three were charged and three were found. The first, a little bit more background. This arises out of Mr. Olson's representation of a lady named Melissa Malott in a employment discrimination case in federal court. As the exhibits indicate, Ms. Malott sought more than $1 million in damages, including back pay, front pay, etc. The case was filed. Ms. Malott was terminated in January of 2009. The case was filed in October of 2009. By January or February of 2010, Ms. Walker, who represented the defendant, provided Mr. Olson documents demonstrating that Ms. Malott had been employed as much as 8 or 9 or 10 days after her termination, initially by a company called Blackstone Technology Group, the contractor with Quest, and then by Quest itself. And he provided these documents to Mr. Olson, and an initial response I'd like to make to Mr. Olson's argument is that he says Ms. Walker admitted, and he's very careful, it's very vague. Ms. Walker admitted that she didn't provide him documents, and that refutes the hearing board's findings. But what the hearing board found was that Mr. Olson maintained that Ms. Walker had not provided the payroll documents, the Blackstone and Quest documents, and they made that finding, I believe, at page 31 of their opinion. And in fact, Mr. Olson admitted in his answer that he had received those documents. And furthermore, the People's Exhibit 48, which is a transcript of a hearing held before Judge Brimmer on December 27, 2010, Judge Brewer asks Mr. Olson about these documents, and he says, Mr. Olson, did you believe that this business about Blackstone and Quest was all just a total fiction? Did you think that she was actually working there and had earned money? And Mr. Olson says, that began at line 7, page 42. Your Honor, I believe she had earned what she said she did in her deposition in the court. No, I mean, you got all sorts of documents. Documents were provided to you early on, the ones that are attached as exhibits A30 and A32. Did you look at those? Mr. Olson, absolutely, Your Honor. The court, when did you look at those? Mr. Olson, I can't recall the date, but surely upon receiving them, within days I went through them myself. However, I wanted to tell the court what we did then as a consequence of receiving those documents. And then Mr. Olson goes on to tell federal judge how he claimed to have investigated the information in those documents at Quest. That's a separate issue. But Mr. Olson received this information January, February of 2010. April 16th of 2010 is an important day. That's the day Ms. Mallott gets deposed. And she's confronted with these payroll documents. And she's confronted with the issue of her use of two social security numbers in connection with the receipt of the income, showing the documents. These documents are W-2s, employment contracts, I-9, 1099s, these sorts of things. And she first equivocated. Prior to this time, she had submitted discovery responses saying that she hadn't been employed for compensation, words to that effect. When confronted with the documents, she starts saying, well, I was a contractor, I wasn't an employee, my wages at Quest were frozen, she says, and this is important because later on Mr. Olson uses a deliberate deceit to talk about his investigation at Quest and the frozen wages. But she goes on to give some remarkable responses. She's also questioned about the use of two social security numbers. And here she gives detailed responses under oath about how an officer where her husband had been stationed had given her a packet of information that included a federal locator number. This wasn't a social security number. And that this federal locator number was given to her to use instead of her social security number to mask her husband's top secret clearance. Ms. Walker reaches out to Mr. Olson on April, sends a letter and says this is incredible. She subsequently files a motion to dismiss on June 10th, this is the People's Exhibit 4. And Mr. Olson then says he needs more time to investigate this. He asked the court for more time to look into these issues. But on the end of July, Mr. Olson files a response to the motion to dismiss. And now Ms. Mallott's story has changed completely. It's not a federal locator number, it's a temporary social security number. And he attaches documents to this response in which he claims come from the Social Security Administration, but they misspelled the word temporary. He attaches documents to this which indicate that this temporary number had just been assigned to her on November of 2008, but she had previously given Blackstone, and he had been given, a Social Security card for Blackstone that was dated February of 2008. It just didn't add up. And bottom line, the findings of the tribunal are well supported by the evidence.
Counsel, just let me stop you right there. I just want to read this line from the dissent, and I want you to respond, where the dissent says, I'm concerned that finding a violation here opens the door to prosecute all attorneys who have had the misfortune to represent clients whose stories turn out to be false. Can you help me there? I mean, essentially it's saying, hey, the client here was speaking falsehoods. Well, what is an attorney supposed to do in this situation?
Okay. Well, I think the operative language from the word from the language you quoted is here. Finding a violation here. I disagree respectfully that finding a violation here with respect to these facts would in any way jeopardize the legal profession or serve as a disservice to the profession and the integrity of the profession. There, Rule 3.1 envisions a wide range of conduct. We could imagine a lawyer who gets bad information from a client, files a complaint, learns that information is bad, and dismisses the complaint. And would I be here talking to you or to the disciplinary judge about that matter? Of course not. That lawyer made a mistake, he committed, and when he found out, he didn't do anything. In the case at bar, we are at the other end of the spectrum. We have a client who is making factual claims that on their face are unreasonable, some of them. That there is evidence, overwhelming evidence, refuting those claims. A second indicia of unreasonableness in this case. Third indicia, the evidence, there was an absence of corroborating evidence for her claims, just an absence. Fourth, the information that Mr. Olson supplied to support the claims was unreliable. The temporary Social Security document with the misspelling. Fifth, the information that Mr. Olson supplied to support the claims was contradictory. The Social Security card with one date, the temporary Social Security information with another date. And finally, a dearth of reliable information to show that Mr. Olson engaged in any kind of investigation. Mr. Olson told you just now about he hired an investigator to check out Sandra Prince in Florida. He went to Blackstone. He told the hearing board about that too. The problem is, in the more than 2,000 pages of documents that we exchanged in this case, and there's not one note concerning that investigation. He can't tell you the name of the investigator he hired in Florida. Can't tell you the names of the people he talked to at Blackstone. So to your question, Your Honor, it's a matter of degree. We have to rely that our hearing board will, as they did here, sift through the evidence and make a determination. Is this so unreasonable, so objectively unreasonable, as to constitute a rule violation? And to make a finding of a violation here, under these facts, and in this case, I get back to my initial point, does no disservice to the legal community. And to the contrary, does a great service to the legal community and the integrity of the profession because of the condition that I just shared.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
You each present this. It's difficult for us to deal with all these factual. We've read the order and such, but we'll have to sit through all the many factual things you all talked about. But on its face, you each present as if the situation is clear. It's either outrageous and unreasonable, or it's perfectly reasonable, and yet you have a split board, and each writing in some detail about why they see the problem differently in terms of whether it's reasonable or not. Could you address that? Do you have any explanation?
I have a couple of responses, one of which goes back to Justice Ide's question because it's another important point. And that is this conduct took place over a period of time. It wasn't a single decision at a single time that was frivolous. It was Mr. Olson advancing these claims and advancing these claims in the most zealous, the most no holds barred, the most forceful way over time. And that is another aspect. How we distinguish it. I think that the dissent writes more from the point of view, quite frankly, of a criminal defense attorney who says, I can believe my client at all costs because the other side has to prove their case. But we're in a civil case. We're analyzing conduct in a civil case. And I think that the dissent has gotten a few things wrong along the way. I think one of the legal errors that the dissent makes, and Mr. Olson has picked up on this in his argument, sort of carried the ball, is that the dissent argues that the people did not produce any evidence to show once and for all that Ms. Malott had stolen Ms. Prince's Social Security number. We didn't. We would have loved to, but we didn't. And the reason is, it's irrelevant, and it would have been prejudicial to Mr. Olson. Because the issue before the hearing board were the claims that Mr. Olson advanced, based on the information he had at the time, reasonable. And so, to the extent the dissent wanted to hear about other matters not in the record, about matters relating to Ms. Malott and her veracity that Mr. Olson hadn't heard about. Those things shouldn't have fit in it, and we didn't, and we deliberately did not offer those into evidence. But the dissent wanted that information. The dissent also, is incorrect about the federal district court not hearing Mr. Olson's explanations for his conduct. Again, our exhibit 48 from pages 39 through 85 includes a lengthy colloquy between Judge Brimmer and Mr. Olson about these three issues. And how could you believe this? And how can Mr. Olson answering Judge Brimmer's questions on those points? So the dissent is incorrect on that point. But ultimately, Your Honor, the dissent is not so far apart from the majority in the sense that it does find that Ms. Mellott was, he says, could not be trusted, and her pattern of deception was revealed, at least as to the third issue, her travels. So the dissent even acknowledges that on this point, Ms. Mellott finally gave up the game and couldn't be trusted. And yet Olson persisted, Mr. Olson persisted in advancing this position even after this point in time, October of 2010, when the dissent finds that Ms. Mellott is no longer objectively reasonable to follow Ms. Mellott. So I don't think that the dissent is that far apart. The dissent does not, importantly, disagree with the majority concerning the legal standard to be employed here. Everyone agrees it's the subjective, it's objective reasonableness. But it's just, this is why we have hearing boards, Your Honor. That one member couldn't get to the place that the other two could.
And if I can just follow up on that, it seems a little bit, especially with the last part you were saying, that this is a debate about their understanding of what it means to be reasonable conduct. And with regard to that, would you agree, as I believe I heard Mr. Olson say, that that's a matter of law and we should decide that as well?
Would I agree? I'm not following.
The question of what it means to be reasonable conduct, is that an objective standard that is one of law?
I think that it varies based on the facts of the case, and for the reasons that I shared with Justice Ide, I think in this case, given the all of those factors, Mr. Olson's conduct was unreasonable. Now, this court might say that, you know, one of those additions isn't enough. It takes two or four or three, you know, in future cases for hearing boards to determine. But I think that ultimately we should trust our system and our hearing boards to make these findings and to make these judgments. And ultimately, of course, under 251.1, you have jurisdiction if you really disagree with the determination.
And I didn't mean to be challenging our structure about facts versus law, but we have as we've been through many times here, we have an unusual animal here,
yes,
in which the board is making findings of facts, but they're also determining law and applying sanctions.
Yes, they're interpreting those rules and doing so in the context of other, you know, cases, both within and without the state of Colorado, what those rules mean. Absolutely. Now, the sanction issue is a very different issue. The sanction issue is, the court will notice, is based on the ABA standards. And in that respect, the hearing board, quite properly under the Attorney F decision, followed the guidance there and made a determination based on all circumstances, facts and circumstances of Attorney F, that even though the initial guideline recommended public reprimand based on the aggravation here, a substantial aggravation, that Mr. Olson should be suspended for 6 months with requirement of reinstatement. And in doing that, made the findings concerning state of mind, aggravation, harm, etc. Mr. Olson challenges that sanction to some degree. He says that, first of all, in his brief, he didn't discuss it today, he didn't like the way that his other discipline was handled. There's no dispute that he had another discipline or that it reflected a pattern of misconduct, or that it was relevant, and he's citing cases this court clearly shows that it was, and that the PDJ went to measures to make sure that it was handled appropriately. With respect to the deceptive practices issue, Mr. Olson wants to talk about the Social Security issue, and so we will. I'd like to flesh out the whole story for a minute. Before trial, even though we had exchanged thousands of pages of paper, shortly before trial, I received from Mr. Olson a document purporting to be a receipt from the Social Security office. Almost like a bakery receipt, so take a number, only it was computer generated, had a number. And I knew that this was going to be offered to show that he had made an investigation of Ms. Mellott's Social Security status. In any event, I sent my investigator, Rory Seed, to the Boulder Social Security Office. That was her job. Go to the Boulder Social Security Office, get a receipt, and see what it looks like. Because I, in my experience, have never received a computer-generated receipt that doesn't have a date and a time on it. This one didn't. She went, she came back, and sure enough, hers had a date and a time on it. Went to hearing, and sure enough, Mr. Olson offered his to prove that he had done this investigation, but it lacked a date and time. And so I called Ms. Seed. Rebuttalist. And the court made a point noting the differences in the receipt. Mr. Olson, on cross-examination of Ms. Seed, was asked, which office did you go to? Implication being, maybe my office, the one I went to, didn't date stamp receipts, but the one you went to did. And she said, I went to the one in Boulder, the one I could find in Boulder. Now, the implication was that Mr. Olson was trying to cover his tracks with the cross-examination and cross-examining her deceptively, that she had gone to a different Social Security office. Mr. Olson did not testify during the hearing that he had looked at the internet and determined that there was more than one office at that time. So the court, or the hearing board, issued its decision, and one of the aggravating factors that it found was that Mr. Olson had engaged in deceptive practices during the hearing. And that those deceptive practices, it enumerated several. One of them was the way in which Mr. Olson had cross-examined the seat, implying that there were two Social Security offices. And the court then took judicial notice, not by going to the internet, but by going to a particular website on the internet, which is the Federal Social Security website, which is a reliable website on the internet, to determine that there is one Social Security office in Boulder.
Counsel, I'm sorry, let me stop you there. Yeah. So did the other office just not exist, or it was just not listed under Boulder?
As we did right here along, we attached to our brief an appendix that showed that, Mr. Olson challenged us on appeal by attaching these screenshots. So we then sent Ms. C back out. And she went to the Boulder Social Security office and spoke to the person who runs the office and said, no, the population isn't big enough in Boulder to support two offices. There's one office, always has been one office. It's now here. It used to be at this other address. So these two addresses represent the prior and current office, but there's only been one at a time. So we attached a letter from him and also a letter from, I think, the property manager of the former address.
But okay, let me follow up then. Yeah. If we just set aside the Social Security office problem, help me understand, let's just assume we are not going to count that.
Sure.
What are the remaining deceptive practices that you alluded to?
Well, first of all, Mr. Olson's insistence that he did not receive documents from his walker, that he did not receive the payroll documents from his walker. This goes back to page 31, and I read to you the colloquy between Judge River and the fact that Mr. Olson's answer refused that. Another deceptive practice, and the court found with respect to Mr. Olson's credibility generally, that he, quote, had a penchant for mischaracterizing the evidence. And it, under the deceptive practices portion of the opinion, also points on the third way that he did mischaracterize the evidence throughout the proceeding. It talks about that. That's the third basis for that aggregate.
Does that, these terms are always, it's kind of hard for us to tell exactly what's involved. But so are you saying with that then that basically he misrepresented things to the court? He either perjured himself or, as an attorney, he misrepresented things to the court?
I think that's what the hearing board is saying, and I concur, Your Honor.
He said something was that wasn't.
Yes, and I can give you an example. Mm-hmm. And the thing about this is there are many layers. This took place in federal court. This took place before the hearing board, and it's taken place in the briefs here again. Here's an example. There's an issue as to whether Ms. Malott had earned the wages in the documents that Mr. Olson had been given from Quest. So Mr. Olson says he went to talk to a fellow named Cody Greenwald, who was an employee at Quest. And Mr. Greenwald testified. He's in the third folio of the transcripts, the third day testimony. That yes, Mr. Olson had come to him, but had never discussed with him whether the W-2 for 2009 was valid, whether wages were frozen in 2009, whether any of the Quest documents that he had been given by Ms. Walker were accurate. Well, Mr. Olson keeps talking about Mr. Greenwald confirmed that there was a freeze. Yes, because when Mr. Greenwald began investigating Ms. Mulott in July of 2010, Quest froze her wages because they were investigating her for, among other things, Social Security fraud. And so, but Mr. Olson constantly talks about talking to Mr. Greenwald about a freeze and blends it in with this discussion of whether her 2009 wages were frozen. He did the same thing, as I mentioned earlier, when he talks about did he get documents from Ms. Walker. Documents generally instead of the wage and income documents. He does, those are two examples.
You got me going now on the story of the receipt. Was okay, there any finding about the validity of the receipt?
So, yes, I need to follow. So we got the receipt. The court made this determination, engaged in deceptive practices, engaged in judicial notice. In our brief, I think we explained that it was appropriate in all respects. And then, because I believe that Mr. Olson's submission of the screenshots to the brief was a further example of mischaracterizing evidence. It was the same thing he had done in the Mulott case, like submitting Social Security records with the word temporary misspelled and with dates that contradict themselves. Although we originally agreed to a stay so long as the conditions could be put on it, Mr. Molson could be monitored, I moved to revoke the stay, arguing that he was now engaging in the same conduct before this court. The hearing board issued an order in denying my motion. It did not in any way issue an order finding that Mr. Molson reversing itself in any respect with respect to what Mr. Molson had done in the trial below. And I filed in this court, Mr. Olson had moved to supplement the record here with the motion for stay and the order that on. I filed a response that it shouldn't be supplemented. You supplemented the record, but my position on this is set forth clearly in my response to supplement the record. Simply that the language of Judge Lucero's order, the hearing board's order, does not in any way reverse it below.
Does it say something that suggests it's reversing itself? Why are we so far apart?
What the judge says in the order was, and I thought I quoted it in my response, the judge said, we cannot find that respondent's stay should be lifted. Although respondent could have been clearer in his appeal, he does not explicitly assert that there are two Social Security Administration offices in italics in Boulder. Instead, he asserts that there are two such addresses listed on the internet, which he says form the basis for a good faith belief during the disciplinary proceeding that two such offices existed. Well, there's no testimony in the record of the disciplinary proceeding that the internet formed the basis for his belief.
Except that alleged deception formed an aggravating factor for purposes of establishing the 6 months suspension.
I'm sorry. The aggravating factor was Mr. Olson's misleading cross-examination in the C and the suggestion that he had gone to a different office. Not that he had traveled to it, not that he had found it on the internet, or that there were two addresses on the internet. That only came about in the decision. And this court has in the past, I know, reprimanded lawyers simply for asking misleading questions on cross-examination when there's no factual basis for it. No, none at the time. Sanctions. So we have the deceptive practices. We also have Mr. Olson's failure to recognize the wrongful nature of his conduct. Mr. Olson has a habit of blaming others for his situation. He blamed Ms. Walker, both during the federal case and the disciplinary case, that she was defrauding him and that she was acting improperly. During the disciplinary case, he blamed Judge Brimmer, saying that he was an inexperienced judge who just wanted to send a message to him. He blamed me, of course, and he blamed then the PDJ, also seeking twice, although the ground never changed, to disqualify him from presiding over the proceedings.
To what extent on the findings or even on the assessment of the degree of sanction? Are there credibility determinations that we cannot second guess at play here?
Well, the court the hearing board, the majority of the hearing board, makes an outright statement on page 23 of their decision that Mr. Olson is not, that they find that he is not credible. And they say that he is not credible because they talk about he's not credible, his mischaracterization of the evidence, his deceptive practices, a quote penchant for misstating the evidence, his demeanor, and his lack of evidence to support his claims. Those are the basis, but they make that outright statement. They also make other statements, and I can't give you the cite, in which they find that on certain points Ms. Walker is simply credible and Mr. Olson is not. And to the extent they make those determinations, yes, I think this court is bound by it. And I'll go back to the overarching consideration, which I think that this decision represents a very well, not only reasoned, but very well, from an evidentiary standpoint, research decision. And it was documented in the footnotes, the couple hundred footnotes of the decision, what each evidentiary basis is for the position they take. I think that Mr. Olson's challenge is that he says that he's being held to a strict liability standard, yet he acknowledges his state of mind is determined to be negative.
What about this allegation of lack of due process based on judicial notice and not affording Mr. Olson the opportunity to confront and refute that?
Well, he raises the due process issue with respect to the lack of majority decision. And this court has addressed in the Smith case cited in our brief that there is an electing jury in these proceedings, that unanimity is a jury trial concept. And there being no electing jury trial, we take the position that he's not being denied due process or any other right.
I'm taking judicial notice.
Our brief is very thorough on this point. We think that Rule 201 was followed. We also think that Mr. Olson waived that because you have to make timely objection. He got a copy of the decision. He filed a 60-page motion to reconsider. Never raised the issue of the internet search by the court at that time. We think that he waived under 201, and we cited cases to that effect. But we also think it was entirely appropriate. It's an adjudicative fact. Reliable. Resources were used, and we think it's interesting. No, thank you.
Right, thank you. Mr. Olson?
Thank you. Your Honor, I would like to read on with Judge Sarah's subsequent decision on the issue of whether I deceived anybody in my questioning. Mr. Mortimer has failed, as he sometimes does, to tell the full story. Judge Lucero denied his motion to lift the stay and to activate the sanction and ruled as follows. Instead, he, that is Mr. Olson, me, asserts that there are two such Social Security addresses listed on the internet, which he says form the basis for a good faith belief during the disciplinary hearing that two such offices existed. The people have not articulated legal grounds sufficient to warrant lifting respondent's stay, nor have they persuaded us that respondent's representation to the Colorado Supreme Court violated a rule of professional conduct. This was a question of my good faith belief that there were two addresses in Boulder for a Social Security office, so I can find out which one to go to. A year or a year and a half before he sent his investigator out, we don't even know what happened with the tags there, or why there'd be a discrepancy, or even what office she really went to. Because the judges did this behind closed doors and didn't give us a chance to even discuss this issue, which was really not even an issue in the trial itself. Mr. Mortimer is trying to say to Your Honor that I did not go to the Social Security office. He also claimed that I didn't go to Quest. You have before you the testimony of the Quest attorney I went to, where he says, yes, Mr. Olson did come to me. Yes, I received letters and calls. Mr. Greenwald is his name, and he testified, and Mr. Lucero appears to have forgotten that in his decision, where I pressed his lawyer and said, what is going on here? Did she work for you or not? And he clammed up, although he refused to provide any documents, And that was established by my testimony at volume 3, pages 63-64. He also testified that he was conducting his own inquiry and that her wages had been frozen because of it. In other words, she hadn't been paid everything that she was owed, which she had been saying as well. He remembered receiving my written communications in the form of emails, also follow-up letters, including my last one that said, if you have any more questions for Melissa, please let me know right away and I can assist you in setting up an interview. Through today, Mr. Mortimer still contended that I didn't make a good faith effort to go to Quest to find out what was going on. We had a hearing, an adversarial hearing. If Mr. Mortimer felt that way in that hearing, he should have presented his evidence that we never went to Quest or Blackstone. He should have presented his evidence that we didn't telephone her in Germany and refute my phone records, which were admitted to evidence, showing that. I used to be in the Army. I know what it's like to live near a base when your family's trying to move there. She was in hotels in Germany, proven by her credit card statements. She went to the base supermarket, proven by her credit card entries. Her passport showed her visits to Germany. And finally, about the issue of credit cards, and I hate to be hung up on something like this, but if you look at Judge Lyon's decision, you will see that he recognized that there was no admissible evidence in this hearing that we had, that our client had misused the Social Security number. Why did he find that? Because there wasn't it. Mr. Mortimer didn't bring it. Remember, Mr. Mortimer had the opportunity. He had Ms. Walker as the complaining witness, and she was Ms. Prince's lawyer in Barter.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I appreciate your presentation of your argument, as I do yours as well, Mr. Mortimer. The court will be in recess until tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thank you.